Okay, we are going to get started. Thank you so much. If you have come to be a part of this process, we really appreciate it. If you've not come in the past and you want to be involved in making comments, please make sure there are comment cards in the back and that you fill them out and you bring them up to either Chris or Morgan so that we can process those as we move along. Other than that, we're going to get started. So, first of all, we're going to do approval of the last minutes and agenda. So, do I have a motion on that?
So moved.
Okay. So, I have.
Second.
Okay. So, all in favor? And that is unanimous. That is passed. Thank you. So we're going to then go from, this is me, huh?
It's you.
Oh, so I want to state that I was slightly unprepared for this. I didn't do my job today, and that's why we were joking that Mercury is in retrograde, and that's the explanation for it. So I'm going to give you an update on the Wildlife Board, and I just wanted to go over a couple things that we had discussed a little bit, and one was on, let's back up a little bit. I know we had a little bit of a discussion on the wild turkey recommendations, and one was that we wanted to exclude rimfire. That was my memory of that. And that we also had a recommendation by Kent for them to consider dual species and overlapping that. And they just approved the recommendations as proposed. So that included rimfire. Is that what was your memory of that? And then the big thing was the Mineral Mountain Bighorn Sheep transplant, and that went on for quite a long time. I was going to say, yeah, quite a few hours. Quite a bit of opposition from the wool growers in that area. They went ahead and decided to approve that transplant. There was a discussion of putting together an MOU that would involve the state and those and the wool growers. That transplant would not be contingent upon that MOU, but that they would attempt to put an MOU together. But that transplant is going to take place. And other than that, there was just a lot of small things. I don't know if you want me to, should I go through all of that? Everything, there was nothing else that stood out to me. Are there questions, anything that you guys had? Yeah, the Coyote Bounty Program passed. There's nothing else I could. There was nothing else. Do you guys have anything else that you were? Sorry, again, I didn't do my homework.
That's all right. I just have one comment here. You ticked my brain with the bighorn thing.
Yeah.
One of my guys was watching three ewes behind the house at Nash the other day.
Nice.
Yeah, there's bighorn sheep in Nash, so. Thought you
That's
might
great.
Be interested in that.
That's
Thank
great.
You for that information. Brad, you hear that? Is Brad here?
Okay. Yeah, he's here.
Thank you.
Is that out of their boundary then?
It's where they were clearing them out because of the disease. They were behind the ranch house there, right by the gate in the canyon.
That's where bears.
Yeah.
High up Nash. That's where all bears run the sheep.
Right. Yeah, they're right there.
So what will you do there, Brad? Just curious.
What we typically do is we don't want to overlap with domestic sheep, and we'll have a hunter go harvest those.
Yeah, we'll have hunters harvest any rams, and then the division will move. No, I think we have the ability now for hunters to also harvest the ewes. Yeah, okay.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
That just came
That's
to my
comment.
Mind.
Thank yeah, you. Good comment. All right, so we're going to move on if you guys don't have any more questions about that. So we have the regional update from Chris.
Good evening. Welcome. I'm glad you're all here. We have a quorum. That's great. We've had a busy, hot summer. So our biologists and our seasonal employees we have for the summer are doing some really good things. Our aquatic section, they've been at Schofield and doing electrofishing surveys, and they've found lots of healthy rainbows that we've stocked, and the cutthroat trout are also looking really good. So that's an indication that our management plan there that was passed about a year ago or so is working. And so that was good news. We're going to do a second known treatment in the Farron Creek drainage area in September. We've been working in that area for several years now. We usually do two rounds of rotenone treatment to ensure that the stream is all the non-native fish are removed before we stock it with native cutthroat. They're also looking at Huntington Creek and looking at some restoration potential there. And then we have some big rotenone treatment projects happening in the southern region that our staff is going to be going down to the southern region and helping out on. Our habitat sections, so the fall is the busiest time of the year for the habitat section. So at this point, they know which projects were funded, and they're putting out requisitions, which means they're putting out job descriptions for contractors to bid on. And so contractors are going to our statewide system and looking at various projects that are going to be proposed, and they're bidding on jobs. And so that's going on now, and it'll continue to go on throughout the fall. And that'll be, you know, lop and scatter crews or aerial seeding or bull hogging work, a variety of work. So this week our seasonals went to the Dugway area to trap chuckers. I believe those chuckers are going to the southern region. We're also on a part of the bear team for the Trail Mountain Fire. So we're trying to work with the Forest Service and give our recommendations on seeding and what areas should be seeded and provide resources there. And then we've been busy all summer planting crops at our Gordon Creek Wildlife Management Area. Most of that property is just rangeland, but we do have an area that we have water rights for that we cultivate and try to get some crops growing for the deer and elk and the turkeys that come down. Our law enforcement has been very busy. They provided security for the Trail Mountain Fire and provided thousands of hours cumulatively of work securing roads and helping with that effort. And so the whole month of June consumed a lot of our guys' time. We do have two new hires in our region. The guy on the left, he is Evan Bulla, and he is our new aquatic invasive species interdiction specialist. So he's the guy at Bullfrog who will supervise the crew down there that talks to boaters as they're coming off the boat ramp. He's also oversees the seasonal and the work that's done on the other lakes in the region too. But we're excited to have him on. He actually lives in Monticello when he's not living at Bullfrog. His wife works for the BLM there in Monticello. So we're glad he's accepted a position with us, and he has a lot of AIS experience, and he's doing a good job. We also have a new officer in our Emory County District. James Thomas went to Utah County, transferred over there, left an opening. We opened up to all the officers in the state, and a guy by the name of Chuck Lawrence said, "I want to come to Emory County." He came from Panguitch. And so it was good and refreshing to see someone wanting to come to this part of the state, because sometimes, for whatever reason, people want to stay on the Wasatch Front. So it's always good to get someone come to Castledale. But they've been busy checking anglers and preparing for the upcoming hunting seasons, which started today and for some hunts. So our outreach section has been busy too. This is the time of year where dedicated hunters want to get their projects done before the archery season opens. And so the last several weeks and the upcoming weeks will be very busy for Walt and the guy and Morgan trying to approve dedicated hunter projects and getting those tags to those dedicated hunters. They helped with a Muley event in Moab. That's with the Mule Deer Foundation. It was a kids' youth event. That was a success. We do have a bat night in Moab. It's an RSVP. Is there still openings? Okay, there's no openings. The event is full, but all of you know someone, so we can get you into that event if you're interested. So, and we're actually they have the nets up tonight, and they're trying to catch bats just over by the Crystal Geyser tonight. And so, if you're interested, they'll be there till 1 a.m. After the RAC meeting, if you still have a lot of energy left in you, let me know. I'll give you directions exactly where that is. So. I think I'm going to go for a few minutes and then head home. But we have a waterfowl clinic on September 8th, and then we have a fly fishing clinic in September. Our wildlife section's busy too. I mentioned bat surveys. Those have been going on for a few weeks now. We'll continue them tonight. They've been banding doves at Desert Lake and at Gordon Creek, and they've been doing classifications on antelope, bison, and elk, and also been doing cottonwood rabbit surveys. And they've been putting GPS backpacks. You know, they don't think they collar them. They put them on their backs on sage grouse to help with that research. With that, I'll take any questions if you have any.
How's your fish project in Range Creek handling the drought?
I've heard nothing but wonderful things about the Range Creek project, and I haven't heard any concerns about the drought. Well, so yeah, and that's probably something to mention. Since our last RAC, we restored Range Creek with native cutthroat trout, both on BLM lands, state land, and private lands, TN Ranch and Preston Nutter Ranch properties, and with over 5,000 cutthroat trout. And so it was a great project. Morgan's putting together a video on that. That's really done. It's almost finished. And so once that gets done, I'll send it out to you guys. It's a great 10-minute video or so, 7-minute video that highlights that effort. So, good question.
Do you know how many people are in attendance at that Muley event in Moab?
Attendance was down this year. I think it was 80 or so kids. 50 or 60 or so kids. Last year was like 130. So it's for whatever reason, it's a little down this year, but. That's still a lot for Moab,
that's good,
right?
Yeah.
And there was different stations. There was an archery station, a wildlife identification station, and a shooting station. They have a shooting. Okay, just archery. Okay. Yeah. Nice. Okay.
Okay, we'll set you free.
Say what?
You're free.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so next we have a presentation by Darren DeBlue. How do you say DeBlois?
Yes.
Really? You. Okay, I'll remember that.
It's a hard one.
That's a hard one.
It's my hard-headed Dutch grandfather gave me that name. Okay, Morgan, you got to go tall. That's good. Maybe. That might be too tall. That'd be a switch.
Wow, it's nice. No, it's DeBlois. I don't remember that.
Just have to bend over to move the slides. We'll be okay. Good evening, everybody. It's I'm glad to be here tonight. I've got three items on the agenda tonight. We want to start with the fur bear trapping rule, and we're making some recommended changes. Some of you may remember last year we brought this rule around at this time, and we had some proposed changes. We were concerned with some new data out of the Association for Fish and Wildlife Agencies that indicates that even using best practices, you could expect in a trap set for a coyote to catch a non-target species about 23% of the time. And so we were recommending some changes to the rule in order to make sure that we protect those wildlife species over which we have management authority and management responsibility. And so our intent was not to regulate the take of coyotes and raccoons, only the types of traps that could potentially catch something other than that, that even though you may be primary target, maybe one of those two species. And you may also remember there was quite a bit of discussion about private livestock owners and their ability to control coyotes around their herds. One of the downfalls of that process last year is that we really didn't have good representation in the process by ag or by ag meaning the Department of Agriculture and by agricultural interests. And so the board passed rule changes as we presented them, but they instructed us to put a committee together to look at those concerns, and we did that right after the board meeting last year, within about a month. So it's been almost a year ago that committee was formed. This is a list of the groups that were asked to participate in the committee. I believe everyone there except for the Mule Deer Foundation participated. The Utah Trappers Association actually got their dates mixed up, so they didn't make the meeting. And when we met, we came to a solution rather quickly, and so we didn't have multiple meetings. But we did send our notes to the Trappers Association and collected their feedback on the recommendation. So they were participating, but they weren't physically there at the meeting. But everybody else here on the list was, I think, yeah, everyone else here attended that meeting, all the other groups. We had a pretty good discussion, and we came up with some group objectives. We discussed the changes that we made to the rule and the reasons that we made those changes. And we came to an agreement about four objectives that we wanted to try to ensure that we addressed when making changes to the rule. The first is we wanted to address concerns of livestock producers, which is the thing that sort of got left out of the process last time. The second thing is the biological concern that the division has with protected wildlife. We want to allow, whenever possible, the release of protected wildlife that might get caught in a coyote or raccoon trap. And the third thing, we looked at some data. Actually, they did a study, I think, in 2016. It was Connecticut, Indiana, and Wisconsin, looking at public support for trapping in general. And they found that public support overall was high. And they dug a little deeper, and they found that people in general were okay with trapping as long as they felt like that it was sufficiently regulated, that non-target species could be released, that it was humane as possible. There are several things that they looked at. So we wanted to make sure, and our rule addresses those aspects of trapping in order to maintain public support. So we wanted to make sure we didn't do anything that would erode public support for trapping in Utah. And finally, we made this change last year, but we wanted to make sure this stayed in, and that is to provide legal protection for trappers who accidentally catch protected wildlife in a raccoon or coyote trap, as long as they're complying with the rule. And specifically, that would mean, you know, the jaw spacing, the types of trap you can use, your trap is registered, those kinds of things. And that's kind of a step beyond what we'd do with any other kind of protected wildlife, to actually offer immunity if people are operating in good faith. So again, we had a really good discussion, probably a couple hours, and somewhere during the process we realized that really the biggest concern that the representatives for livestock producers had is this 48-hour trap check. It was difficult for them to always, you know, they've got a lot of things going on, and it's tough for them to check a coyote set every 48 hours. But what they said is, my herders are, you know, more, there was some, the sheep guy said, my herders are with the sheep 24/7. But sometimes they're from Peru or Guatemala or Ecuador. And to get them a trap license and go through all of that is a big hassle. And so what we agreed to do, and this is the recommendation we're making tonight to try to address that, and that is to allow the owner of a trap to designate another person to check and remove wildlife from their traps, provided the following. The trap is appropriately marked with the owner's trap registration number. The person has required licenses when working with fur bearer sets. So that would be, if you intend to trap and keep protected wildlife, you'd have to have a trap, a fur bearer's license and all the necessary licenses for that. In the cases of unprotected wildlife like coyotes and raccoons, all you'd need to have is a trap registration number. You wouldn't need any other licenses. The person does not have a denied or suspended trap registration license, and this is just to cover in case someone gets suspended, they can't get permission from someone else to keep on participating in the activity. They need written authorization from the trap owner, and they need to have that with them. And then finally, the owner assumes criminal liability and civil responsibility for the designated person. So you're responsible to let them know what's legal, what's not legal, as defined by the guidebook and the rule.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
The way that's worded, it says the person has a required license. Is that the trap owner or the person checking?
The person checking, yeah.
So,
but only if they're trying to, only if they're catching protected wildlife. Does that make sense?
So if they're trapping
bobcats,
they have to have a license. But if it's a
wild
trap, the Peruvian
birders
could check.
Exactly, yep. Yeah, go ahead.
They would be authorized under the rule to turn something loose that was on target species.
Exactly, yeah. So this is an effort in order to help landowners comply with that 48-hour trap check. And the sheep man, Brett Selman, was on the panel, and he said that, you know, he's got guys that could do it if we just make it easy for him to do that. The other offshoot of this is, this applies to everybody. So if you've got traps, and you want to mentor a kid or somebody who's interested in getting into trapping, you could authorize them then to go check your traps for you. So that's a little bit of a bonus. But the main intent here is just to make it easier for livestock producers to comply with the rule. The next couple of changes. The first is, we added language, and if you look at your red line, you can see the exact verbiage, but just in a nutshell, that acknowledges that coyotes and raccoons are regulated by the Utah Department of Agriculture and Food. So the division is not, through this rule, trying to usurp authority over those species. We don't have regulatory authority for those. But it does specify what our authority is, and our authority is to conserve and protect wildlife and establish regulations to do so. We have the authority, the wildlife board has the authority to regulate the means by which protected wildlife may be taken. And references in the rule to coyotes and raccoons are solely there to identify the types of devices used to trap those animals and are not intended to assert any kind of management authority over those animals. It's just a way to make sure everybody's clear what we're talking about when we say these kind of devices. So again, we're not trying to regulate coyotes and raccoons. We are regulating devices that at random can take species that we have authority over. And then those were the recommendations that came out of the committee. There's another couple here that we'd like to recommend. First of all, for bobcats, we added some language that clarifies who may legally euthanize a bobcat caught in a trapping device. It essentially just says that if you shoot the bobcat, your tag goes on it. You can't shoot someone else's and put their tag on it. And then finally, there's a little bit of an oversight in the language. Clarifies that owners of domestic pets caught in trapping devices may only disturb the device to remove their pets. The way it read before, it essentially authorized a person to disturb a trap set regardless of whether their pet was caught. And then once they removed their pet, it allowed them to remove the trapping device from the field. And again, that was not our intent, so we cleaned that up and clarified it. What it did is it pertained to law enforcement officers, and we included people that had domestic pets in the same language. So that was fixed. That's all I've got for that.
Thank you. Okay, so let's start with questions from the RAC.
Said that the UDAF was involved. Is the Predator Board, has this brought forth them at all?
No, not formally, but the Commissioner Adams was part of the committee. And so she was part of the discussion. Farm Bureau was there.
I guess the tough thing is, I know you guys have the right to regulate everything on the fur bear end. Mm-hmm. On livestock protection and everything, all of that has to go through the Predator Board, to my understanding,
right?
Unless I'm wrong there.
No, that's right. So what we're saying is that we... Since traps are indiscriminate in terms of what they capture, a person has a reasonable expectation that when they put a trap in the field, they may catch something that's regulated by us. by the authority of the Wildlife Board.
And I understand that. Right. I'm just a little concerned that this hasn't gone through the Predator Board.
No, not as far as I know. No, it hasn't.
And they're the ones that is tasked by the governor as doing all the rules and policies for livestock protection.
Right, right. And, yeah, as far as I know, Jeff, it hasn't on that end. But we do present to that board every year, but not part of this specific rule.
Just had a clarification question. Can you only designate one other representative, or could you designate multiple?
Could be multiple, yeah.
Other questions? So do we have any questions from the audience? If so, you can step up to the microphone.
What about the state trappers doing that same work? They continue doing that?
Right. Yeah, we have a memorandum of understanding with Wildlife Services, and they work with us under that. That gives them some exemptions and things like that. So, yeah, they still would continue to do what they do.
And then also, if I ran an animal control service, then I would be in that place to continue doing that particular work?
Right. There's still that 600-foot buffer. So if you're doing residential kind of stuff, in most cases that I can think of, you wouldn't be
into that. But if I was out protecting a herd of sheep, right, or something that I was setting,
yeah,
with a particular herder, then this would
that would apply. So you could either have your own traps with your own number, or you could be authorized by the landowner if they were his traps to, mm-hmm, do that for him.
Okay.
Any more questions from the audience? So comments from the audience. And Jerry, is this when you wanted to make your comment? Or is it on the next agenda? You want to do it now?
Okay.
All right, so Jerry Swayze.
Okay, a little bit off the topic here.
Okay, that's okay.
But as for this past year, trapping down at Moab along the Klondike Bluff area, the trail mix has came in there and made a lot of bicycle trails in that given area that used to run trap line through, and they've closed it off to four-wheeler UTVs and then routed us out to the old road that skirts the outer perimeter of that. So a lot of dogs out there running on all these trails and stuff that they have. Grand County has a leash law, but in sense there's no marking of it at any of the kiosks that they have for the maps and stuff that they use. So it looks to me like they need to put that ordinance in there to say that dogs must be on a leash. Because if we're being forced out of the area that we're trapping on and being forced outer perimeters of that particular area or wherever you're at, and you got the bicycles going through there, if dog's running loose, then, you know, 30, 40 feet off the trail, that dog's going to be in your trap. Because otherwise, being on a leash, then you have a little barrier there that you could set traps without getting dogs in there for the people that's riding the bikes. So that's the thing I see, and then there's some incidents down there this past winter. If a dog would have been on a leash, it would have probably not got caught in a trap and killed. And so that's always something that needs to be thought about, you know, that the general public doesn't know or not aware of. So
okay. Thank you
there for that.
Any other comments from the audience? Okay, so let's take comments from the rack. Guess pertaining to Jerry's statement, I don't know if the division works with, for example, trail mix on making recommendations. And I was thinking about, they have a kiosk up on outside of Warner Lake that delineates, it's an elk calving area. I mean, I know they made a move that trail originally because it was an elk calving area. And I don't know if the division worked with them to produce that kiosk, like if it's feasible to be working with them to make recommendations.
Yeah, we have a biologist, our impact analysis biologist, who actually reviews all federal actions and state actions and can make recommendations and comments to make their actions more wildlife friendly. And we do that quite often on different, you know, from oil and gas drilling to trail making to, you know, roads, all kinds of potential impacts. And so we'll continue to do that. As far as marking the trail, I think that would, I work with the county commissioners and some of the county folks. I can pass that recommendation along. Okay. I think it's a good one.
I think so too.
We as an agency wouldn't take on that responsibility ourselves, but I think it relates to us and something we can encourage them to do.
Okay. Yeah, I think that would be good.
Darren, is there any way to split this up between livestock protection and fur bear harvest?
It's tough. I mean, these are all things we talked about. We went through, you know, exempting private property, and there's some issues there with statute. We really did discuss it and try to figure out ways to split the two. But
so what was the negative of exempting private property?
It essentially, the reason that we're concerned about that is because it sets a precedent that on private property, protected species of wildlife don't get protected. And
so what about an agricultural exemption?
I don't know that we talked about an agriculture exemption. I think the feeling in the room was that the burden of you know, we had, the licenses were free. We had about 2,300 people come in and get their trap registration license for free. And that's really all you need to do is just put a number on those traps. And then, and now, if this passes, you can have anybody you want go around and check those. And I don't know if that 48 hours is still something that just is a no-go. But that's where everything kind of gelled, and we felt like that was a reasonable ask in the committee that wasn't in order to protect. Again, we don't want to limit someone's ability to control coyotes, and I think what this would do is just, you know, just one thing you've got to do is add a number to your trap, but it also gives you an exemption. So, you know, if you accidentally catch a bobcat, you're not going to get cited for that, and in the past, you'd be taking that risk, and usually in terms of liability, and I may have to call him Ben, but I'll see if I can take a stab at it because I'm not a law guy. But in terms of liability, the courts want to establish whether you were criminally negligent or not, and the argument would be that if you put a trap in the field, you have a reasonable expectation of catching protected wildlife, even if your intent was to catch a coyote. And one analogy, and this may be a dumb one, but if you're in the field and you see a couple coyotes chasing a yearling deer around, and you think, I'm gonna be a good Samaritan, I'm gonna take those dogs out, and you shoot and hit the deer by accident, you're gonna get a ticket. And again, you're responsible to make sure that your shot goes where it needs to go. It's sort of the same kind of concept. If you put a trap in the field with a reasonable expectation of catching protected wildlife, what we're saying is register the trap. We'll give you an exemption as long as you're following the rules if you accidentally catch something you didn't intend to. So that's what the rule says. I don't know if that settles your mind or makes it feel better or not, but that's kind of where we're going.
I guess I don't know how you go forward to fix it any better. I wish we could split it.
Right, yeah.
And I, in fact, I'll make a motion. I wrote it down earlier. That the UDAF and UDNR work together to discuss the concerns get together and discuss what areas of concern the DNR has with coyote and raccoon trapping as it relates to wildlife trapping protected wildlife. And if the UDF agrees, the Predator Management Board can write the rule as allowed to livestock protection. The Predator Board is put there for a reason. It, in my opinion, they're the ones there that are setting the rules and the policies for livestock protection. And I don't really see why we're undermining that board.
I have no objection at all with getting with ag and having that conversation.
I think this needs to run through the Predator Board.
Right. Now, the Predator Board doesn't have authority over method of take. At least that's my understanding. Now, UDAF could pass their own rules through the predator board that says, that has the same kind of, that essentially says you have to follow Division of Wildlife's rules. But I think Marty's our attorney. I don't know if he was here last time. This came up, but we didn't get to the step of the predator board. But we did have discussions about what's the easiest way to do. And we did ask UDAF.
And you're two different things. Right. You're over fur harvest and you're over livestock protection.
Right. Yeah.
And they're basically two different deals, and now we just lumped them together. And
yeah, it's a weird artifact of how we manage or don't manage.
I know the guys on the predator board are very concerned about it.
Right. Yeah.
To the guys on there, and they're not real happy about it.
Okay.
They weren't involved in it.
Right. Yeah, I can talk to Ag, and again, your motion duly noted. So.
Is it so jumbled? Do you need to read it?
It's a bit jumbled. Is it? Okay.
Go ahead.
You have it.
Yeah, I can just let him read it.
Okay.
That helps.
So we have a motion by yes. Let's have you read it.
You want him to read it, or you want me to read it?
Go ahead and read it.
That the UDAF and the UDNR get together and discuss what areas of concerns the DNR has with coyote and raccoon trapping as it regulates to the trapping protected wildlife. And if UDAF agrees, the Predator Management Board can write the rules as it pertains to livestock protection.
So do we have a second on that motion? So it's basically just a motion to prompt a discussion.
Right. I have a question on the motion.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the responsibilities of the Predator Board are. So that's why I'm asking this. But to address that, correct me if I'm wrong, Darren and anybody, but does the Predator Management Board have any say or regulation over wildlife? And if they don't, which I believe that's correct, does that kind of contradict? Because if they kind of give the cattlemen just open range on that, is that a conflict with the protected wildlife?
Well, don't quote me, but I actually think they do, because I think their official title is the Agricultural and Wildlife Damage Board. And the way Mike Linnell and Mike Bodenchuk, who are ex-trapping directors, they were in charge of all this. That they were in charge of where the chopper goes to fly for that before it all got jumped.
Do you have any further information on that?
I presented to that board, and usually what we're presenting is numbers of coyotes taken and some of the data you'll see tonight on livestock damage. I'm not as familiar with the Ag's rules and what the powers of that board are, what the intent of that board is. I think you're right. I think they oversee predator management in the state. Wildlife Services is a federal agency that sort of heads up the on-the-ground work, but the trappers themselves work for Ag, work for the state. And I guess, like I said, I'm perfectly willing to go talk with. I think the first part of your motion we did. We got with Ag. We explained our concerns. We had a discussion. We proposed some changes to the rule to try to address the concerns that the producers in the meeting had. And everybody was okay with it. And I sent emails out and followed up. And I followed up about a month ago and said, hey, we're about ready to hit the racks. If you've got any heartburn, please let us know. And everybody was fine. But we didn't do the next step. We haven't. And I'm, to be frank, I'm going to have to go back and check with our director's office and see what. It's a little bit, you know, I don't know what our role is in all of that. It seems to me like Ag would need to approach their board. I think you're right, though. I don't think that that board has authority over, well, I know it doesn't have authority over protected species. of wildlife and regulating them.
But they are tasked with livestock.
Right, they are, yeah. And so maybe to the extent that this hinders a person's ability, this rule hinders a person's ability to trap coyotes, certainly that they, it seems like, would be interested in weighing in. And I don't know what conversations that the commissioner has had, but I just don't know. So I don't know if they're aware of it. Maybe you've talked to, it sounds like you've talked to some of them. I don't know how aware they are. And it seems to me like they probably have talked to Commissioner Adams as well. That feedback hasn't gotten to me, so I don't know. I don't know what those conversations may or may not have been. So I'm just at a loss. I'm not. I don't know. But again, I'm always willing to talk. We don't want to hinder. Our only interest and where we think our authority lies is with those protected species.
No, and I understand where you're headed and what you're
right,
trying
yeah.
to do. And I just think we need to put livestock protection over here to the side and let that board make those
right.
decisions and rules over us.
I don't know the.
If your fur bear goes, then I understand that. Do whatever right. we need to do to protect it. I've had plenty of dogs caught on federal land in traps that I understand it.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like.
The property deal issues worry me, and I mean the livestock protection deal worries me.
Okay. I'm not sure when that board meets. It seems like they meet once a year.
Usually right in December, right after this.
That sounds about right. We'll be presenting to them, so maybe that's a good time to have that conversation. But
I've had conversation with those guys on the board, and they're very interested in
yeah.
why this wasn't brought to them because
right.
they feel that it was something they needed to see.
Yeah,
maybe that was the fault in UDAF taking it to their board or whoever it was. Yeah. It did not get to the guys.
Okay. I think that's their role. It's their board, and what you know whether they let them know or not, I just don't know. So sounds like what they're telling you is that they weren't aware. But it's just the weird, you know, the surrounding western states treat coyotes and raccoons differently. They're all under their wildlife division, and they have their rules are pretty similar to what we've got here. They if you put a trap out, you've got to have it tagged. But we're not, you know, we're not interested in limiting the number of coyotes a guy can. Or a gal can take. I shouldn't say gal, huh? That's a little bit patronizing. A woman or a man can take on their. I was told that that's anyway. Sorry. It's been a long week already. Sorry about that, Jeff. So let me reach out to them. And obviously you've got a motion on the table. So
do we have a second on that motion, or do we have more comments?
Go ahead, quick Jay. Comment. Jeff, would you be able to, where we're over wildlife, that's what we're discussing, the wildlife side of it. If we move forward with it, and as a RAC, from the wildlife side, we support the DWR with their objectives that way, and the way they've worded it with the contingency that they run it through the Predator Board and have that conversation. So that we can pass it here as a RAC from our side, but that it has to go through them before it's official.
I guess I'm missing your question. Sorry.
So you're more so making a motion.
Yeah, a motion to pass as presented by the DWR with the contingency that they have to run it through the Predator Board before it's official.
Let's back up. So.
In the motion, he can accept it or not.
Okay. Yeah. What do you think about that amendment? Are you accepting of that amendment,
no,
or do you want to?
I'd rather run it the way we've asked to have it run.
So let's go back.
This is how it went through in the Southern Reason yesterday, and it'll have more teeth if more than one RAC go through with the same motion.
Okay, so let's go back to Jeff's first motion. Do we have a second on that motion?
I just have a question. Can I do that?
Yes, sure.
Is just the end language of it, where it's the rule or how it goes, do they have the authority to do that, Chris? Can they do that? The second half of his motion?
So if the first half's already been done, then let's just take that out.
Well, no, yeah, I'm just asking about the second half. If we make this motion and go, can it happen? Can it work? Is it there? I don't know where the procedure.
Can what happen? I'm not.
Go ahead, read the second half of his motion about the board and.
I'm not sure where that authority where it splits and where it
goes from us.
That's what I'm asking you. Can they?
I do know that everything that we present today goes through our two different attorneys that work for the state and work are assigned to our agency, and they've approved everything that we're presenting today. So there's some legal confidence that we have that we feel that we have the ability to pass what we're presenting today.
Well, I know that the ex-trapping guy says that it's not legal. They're putting restrictions on livestock protection, and it is not legal because it is not in their jurisdiction to do that.
Right. The position of our attorney, I talked to Marty today, is that we have authority by, and I explained it before. I hope I'm not flogging a dead horse, but what we're saying here is the Wildlife Board has authority to regulate those mechanisms. If you put a trap in the field because you can trap potentially and likely trap protected wildlife, we can regulate that trap. That's the position of our attorney in the Wildlife Board. I'm not familiar enough with Ag's rule to know how that overlaps. I guess our position is that we're not making, and again, it says it right in the rule, we are not making an effort through this rule to limit the take of unprotected species in any way, but we are regulating a device that can take protected wildlife. That's the position. And beyond that, I think what I need to do with your motion is talk to our director's office, and ultimately I think it's up to the board whether they feel like they have the authority to do this without Ag's Agriculture and Livestock Protection Board or not. That, you know, that's something that's above my pay grade, I guess.
And our attorneys quite often are at Wildlife Board meetings, are asked to come to the pulpit and just explain things and discuss things, and they do that frequently. So something we don't take we don't take lightly. We study these things, and it's their legal opinion that we have this ability to make this amendment.
Well, Jeff, clarify for me, is your motion to initiate a meeting between the two agencies, or to not go with
any rules that apply to the livestock protection have to go through the predator board? And in our opinion, this is limiting our ability to protect our livestock, especially on our own private property. I don't understand how the private property thing doesn't raise a flag to anybody.
So your motion is to not accept this rule amendment, is that?
Until it goes, no. Trying to look at it, see how we can tweak it to make it a little more.
And how does it limit, like mostly just the checking at 48 hours is what you don't like?
I think we still need to follow the rules. It's just that flat out they don't have the jurisdiction to regulate me protecting my livestock.
I have a question. I may not be seeing this completely, but I don't see where anybody is being restricted from protecting their wildlife, their livestock. I don't see that.
What is that?
Yeah, that's my question.
You're not required to pay a fee. All you got to do is get a registration number for your traps. That's free of charge. You go in, you get the number, you apply it to any trap you put in the field. And that's where the division's coming from. And having trapped for a number of years, coyotes are the most difficult thing in the world to catch. If you start trapping, you're going to catch a lot of foxes and a lot of bobcats long before you ever catch a coyote. You need to look, it's just a learning process. They're pretty intelligent. They adapt well. They're difficult to catch. And I think that's where the division's coming from, is we just want to know whose trap it is if something non-target is caught in it.
Is that a correct interpretation?
I don't think they're not telling you can't do it.
No, I know, I understand that.
I guess it's just the fact that
this is coming through a different channel for me than it should.
Right.
This should be coming down the predator board channel.
Let me take a shot at this.
Then
tell me if I'm wrong, Jeff. This is mainly stemming from the private property and the rancher's ability to get rid of the coyotes and raccoons there that are not regulated by fish and game. Am I there?
Yep.
And I think there's always been a disconnect there between DWR and ADC, having kind of watched both sides of it. And I don't really have no heartburn. I think they should be in conjunction with them. I really think you should be talking to them when it comes to this piece. I really do. The only thing I know about them, I don't know if they can do what you're saying at the end. I support your motion. I think we do this, get it done. They ought to go sit down with them. They ought to talk about it and hammer it out, get both sides. But as far as the legality of the end of it, I don't know. You know, that's what I'm saying. If we make the motion and it goes there. They'll sort that out. Chris?
Yeah, they'll definitely. Okay. Yeah, I mean, okay. They'll.
This not the past. It's a week.
Who right. has the authority and over this will definitely be a topic
okay.
at the Wildlife Board.
Okay.
If especially if I didn't really know it was at the Southern Rack, but if it's at several racks, then
okay.
it'll get brought up. And Trish will represent the rack and say this is the discussion we had. And the Wildlife Board does a very good job of going through every region's motions.
Okay.
I don't have any problems with any of the recommendation other than the channel that this for livestock protection needs to come through the Predator Board. Me. For me to go out and protect my cows and whatever my sheep or whatever I have needs to come through the Predator Board.
That makes it a lot easier knowing that the legality, because that's what I was hung up with is, you know.
Well,
what,
apparently their attorneys have already sealed the deal on it, so
well,
I think any of us have a say on it. But
our attorneys, I know, have already studied this issue, and there is their legal opinion that we have the authority to propose this amendment. And I think you'll hear that again at the Wildlife Board, but that doesn't mean you can't make any motion you want and vote on it.
Okay. Go ahead.
Darren?
I just want to clarify, that license was free for a year. Beginning July 1, we started charging for that again, but it's $10. One time, just to make sure that everybody's on the same page on that, and just talking's always good. So, you know, we meet frequently with Wildlife Services and with Ag, and talk these things out, and so that won't stop either. That's all.
Okay, so do we have a second on Jeff's motion to move this forward? We have a second by Daryl Meekum. All in favor? So we have three. Five in favor, and those opposed. We have three opposed.
Name those who are opposed.
And that would be Kirk Player, Jay Skyman, and Dana Truman. How did I do on that, Morgan? Okay. So do we have a motion on the remainder of the proposal?
A motion that we accept it, the proposal as put forth by the
okay, so I have a motion by Jay Skyman to accept the remainder of the division's proposal as presented. Do I have a second on that?
I'll second it.
Okay, a second by Todd Thorne. All in favor? And it is unanimous. Okay. So on to Fur Bear and Bobcat Harvest recommendations. Again.
Okay, now that we've gotten through the rule, we'll move on to recommendations for next season for Bobcat and Fur Bear. And this is going to primarily focus on Bobcat, but we'll make recommendations for seasons for other Fur Bears as well. Just quickly, I wanted to remind everybody how Bobcats are managed in the state. They're managed under the Bobcat Management Plan that was written as part of a committee that got together, looked at all the pertinent data and latest scientific publications, and then had discussions about different needs of different interest groups. And that plan prescribes three management targets that we look at in order to make decisions about permits for bobcats in the state. And the way it works is if two of those three management criteria are outside of the parameters in a way that would negatively affect bobcat populations, we'd recommend changes either to the number of permits a person can have or shorten seasons or both. Okay, so just bear that in mind as we go through these. So the first management criteria for bobcats are the number of juveniles in the harvest. This is based on the aging from teeth when we have those animals checked in. We want to see the number of juveniles between 42 and 56% of the harvested animals. If it's higher than that, that just means there's a lot of juveniles in the system, and that leads to a growing population. If it's less than 42%, that would indicate a lag in production and would be one of maybe two things that might indicate a change. So here's the data on percent juveniles in the harvest from 1999 through last season. The management parameter are the red dotted lines, so we want to fall either in between those lines or above them. And you can see over the last 5 years we've either been within or above. It looks like we took a little bit of a drop since last year, but again, it's still within management parameters. The second criteria is adult survival. We calculate the percent of adults that are surviving annually based on the data we get back from harvest. We want that adult survival number to be somewhere between 65 and 72%. Again, if it's higher than that, that just means that there's opportunity and that adults are in the population to reproduce. If it's below 65, we're probably hitting adult bobcats a little bit too hard, and we want to look at changes. So higher is okay, lower is where you'd want to look at changes. So here's the data on adult survival. Again, the red dashed lines are the management parameters, and you can see the data here. It looks like the last couple of years we've seen a decrease in overall adult survival. So this is one parameter that's outside of the management parameters in a way that would potentially negatively affect populations. And the third criteria are the percent of females in the harvest. We want to see that be somewhere between 41 and 45%. In this case, if it's lower than that, that just means that people aren't harvesting a lot of females. There should be still enough females in the population to do the reproducing. And that's good for bobcat populations. So higher than 45% would be where we'd be affecting populations potentially in a negative way. Here's the data on that. Again, the dashed lines are the management parameters, and the blue line is the data. So that jumped up. Last year's actually on a decline. We saw an uptick there, but it's still within the management parameters. So this shows the data for the last 3 years in the management ranges. So according to the plan, two out of the three parameters are still within the management targets. And so we won't be recommending any changes to permits or seasons this year. We think some of the negative trends that we saw pertains primarily to a dip in rabbit numbers. We've seen a decline in rabbit numbers over the last few years, and that's probably starting to show up a little bit in our bobcat population. But for this year, we're still, according to the plan, okay to stay the course. If those trends continue, then you may see some different recommendations moving forward. So this is what it looks like, six tags per individual. The season there is just adjusted for the calendar year, so same as last year, and there'd be no cap on the number of permits sold. And then these are the season dates we're proposing for the other fur-bearing species. So for beaver and mink, September 22nd through April 3rd. That's just adjusted for the calendar. That's the same as last year. And then all those other species would go through March 1st. That's it.
Okay, so I have questions from the rack.
Yeah. Aaron. You have data on the overall number of cats taken. Everything you're putting up there is a percentage.
I do.
The number of cats staying pretty static year to year? Is the total number
actually,
of
I
cats
think,
going down or up or
let
what?
Me look. I think I have it in here.
Let me get that for you.
Okay.
works, it's great, but okay, here we go. Okay, numbers wise, were you interested in a trend or just what
you
was
want
taken?
2 years data?
Your trending would be good.
Yeah, we could do that. So total harvest, so 15 and 16 total harvest, 1683 in 16-17, 1856. And in 17-18, 2,945, so it's trending up. And one of the biggest drivers of that is pelt price. So, you know, it seems like as pelt price increases, people hit it harder. I think combined with that, we've got this. This is our trends for cottontail rabbit surveys, and we've got this declining prey population. So, yeah, we'll have to keep an eye on it. But, you know, the plan is in place. It's intended to pick up those shifts in population, and we'd make adjustments accordingly.
Other questions from the rack?
Just to confirm, that female percent female take is like right on the border.
Yes, yeah.
Tripping, right?
And it's trending that way. So the intent of the plan is to be, you know, give people a chance to go out and do this. So that's why we want to have two things out, but it's definitely headed that direction. And you know, I suspect with the way the rabbit numbers are, we may see. But again, we really had quite a few bobcats taken this season too. We'll have to see what the pelt price does. Sometimes they flood the market and it goes down and people are less interested. So
probably a good chance that next year there will be a reduction in numbers.
It's looking that way, or a season shorter, something like that.
Questions from the rack? Questions from the audience?
Weather factor on that?
We don't really have any data, but you know, to the extent that drought might affect prey numbers, I would suspect, yeah.
Darren, were those numbers you just read off, was that tag numbers or was that harvest?
I thought it was harvest, but let me just double check, Darius. I'm getting old, and sometimes the columns. That's total harvest, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
And do you tease any of this data out regionally, or is it all statewide combined?
Yeah, it's statewide combined.
I mean, internally you don't do it by smaller management units as well, or is it?
I don't think so. Let me just.
I was just wondering if you're. Your prey cycle is statewide, or if it's regional based on?
It's statewide, yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, obviously you're going to have variation throughout the state. I need to look, and I think I know where we do ask where they took them, so we could probably do that. But for purposes of the plan and for the recommendation, it's a statewide.
Okay. I was just. I guess I'm just not seeing the rabbit numbers dropping here, so I'm just curious on if it's a good representative sample of the state, or if it's focused on the West Desert with jackrabbits more than cottontails.
The rabbit we have rabbit routes throughout the state, but I'm not 100% familiar with where. I know the northern region, they have one in Rich County and one out in Box Elder County, and so it's
yes.
Those occur in other regions too, but that's kind of how it goes.
Could you put one of those in my backyard?
Rabbit or a bobcat?
Any more questions from the audience? I don't think we have any comments from the audience. We don't have any comment cards. So, comments from the rack. We entertain a motion.
Motion to accept the division's proposal as presented.
Okay, we have a motion by Kent Johnson to accept the division's proposal as presented.
I'll second.
And a second by Eric Luke. All in favor? That is unanimous. Okay, here we go. So we have a presentation by Darren for Cougar recommendations.
Right.
Amendments.
So now that we've got the controversial stuff out of the way.
Let's just slide into the rest of the evening.
This will be easy. Okay, tonight, final thing I have is Cougar recommendations for the upcoming season. Similar to what I did with Bobcats, I just wanted to remind the members of the RAC and also the audience how we manage Cougars in the state. Cougars are managed according to the Cougar Management Plan, which was enacted in 2015. That was a product that came to the Wildlife Board from a Cougar Advisory Group. And that group was comprised of many people from many different perspectives, including cougar hunters, big game hunters, people at large, non-consumptive users, scientists from Utah State that specialize in cougar biology and research. And they met many times over several weeks, hashed through many different issues, and came up with some recommendations and targets for us to use in order to manage a healthy cougar population in the state. So the plan's goal is to maintain a healthy cougar population within their current distribution while considering human safety, economic concerns, so that'd be the livestock component, other wildlife species, so that'd be prey components, and maintaining hunting traditions. So those are the objectives of the plan. And we define in the plan a healthy cougar population as one with a reasonable proportion of older age animals, breeding females, healthy individuals, a population in balance with its natural prey and genetic variability. So that's what we're shooting for. So we have a couple of management parameters for mountain lions, similar to what we just talked about with bobcats. There's just two for lions. The first is the percent of females pooled over the previous 3 years. So what we do is we look at last year, but we also look at the 2 years prior to that. We put all those numbers together, and we calculate the percent of females in that harvest over 3 years. The second management parameter is the number of older adults in the harvester, 5 years and older, over the last 3 years. And we want that to be between 15 and 20%. So the thinking here, and this is based on research that was done by Mike Wolf and Dave Stoner on the Monroe and the Oakers. What they did is they actually enumerated the number of animals they had there. They looked at these kind of statistics that we collect from the animals that are turned in to us, and they tried to determine, you know, what numbers would indicate a stable lion population based on populations where they actually knew how many they had. And they found that these two parameters did the best of doing that. If you can maintain percent females below 40%, keep an older age class between 15 or 20, you should see a stable population. So we're shooting for that, but we temper that a little bit. If we've got units with livestock depredation concerns, we can take that into account according to the plan, where we may actually be trying to lower, we're not trying to maintain, we're trying to actually lower the number of mountain lions in that area. And so in that case, you could go over 40% on your female harvest. There's a couple of units. You'll see that's the case. And then same thing with older age classes. We hunt mountain lions in under three different harvest strategies. The first is a straight limited entry season where there's a 10 permits for a unit. People put in for the draw. If they draw a permit, they can go hunt. If the season ends and they haven't harvested a lion, then the hunt's over. And so that's how that works. The other end of that spectrum is harvest objective. On these units, we set a quota of the number of lions that can be harvested in that unit. And that unit will remain open until that number of mountain lions is harvested. So if it's 10, it would stay open until they harvest 10. Once they harvest that 10th lion, the unit closes. And then a split unit is a little bit of both. It starts as limited entry. If they had 10 permits and 4 people didn't harvest a lion during the limited entry season, then that area would open up for harvest objective, or anybody who had a permit for a harvest objective season throughout the state could hunt that unit until the final 4 mountain lions were harvested, and then that unit would shut down. Final opportunity to see lions, to pursue lions, are these pursuit seasons. These are seasons where you can pursue a lion, but you can't kill the lion at the end of the pursuit. So it's an opportunity for some people to train dogs or see lions or be out there and participate in their sport, but they don't harvest a lion as a result of those seasons. So having said all that, let's look at a few data points here. This is historical hunter harvest since 1990. The light blue line is the total harvest of mountain lions. The darker blue line are the number of males, and the salmon colored line are the number of females. So we've been trending up since about 2012. Again, harvested lions. Most of that has been among males the last 4 years. You can see females have remained fairly steady since about 2011, that number, regardless of the increasing number of permits and harvest. But last year we did see an uptick in the number of females that were harvested. This graphic just shows, so this pertains to that 40% females in the harvest management objective. So that dashed line is the threshold where statewide we want to try to stay below that. And you can see the salmon colored section are the number of females, the blue are the number, or the proportion, not the number, the proportion of males. And so you can see the trend, and you can see where we've been since about 10 years. The last thing that we look at when we make these decisions, there's many other things. The last thing that I wanted to show you are what the livestock damage numbers look like. On this slide, the blue line are the number of incidences, and an incident is classified as a producer has a lion get in and kill sheep. Most producers can recognize when that happens, but they need to have that verified, and so they'll call Wildlife Services out to do the verification. And so the call to Wildlife Services initiates the process. Once they get on site and verify that it was a lion that killed the livestock, that's an incident. And so we're looking at the trends of these call out and verified lion kills, and you can see it's taken an uptick over the last 4 years. The other line there, the number of lions that Wildlife Services has removed as a result of those incidences. And again, you can see an upward trend with maybe possibly a leveling the last 2 years. It's about 5 incidences a year over the last 3 that's been going up. The other part of this that's important to point out from livestock producers' point of view is we have a budget to pay these verified losses, and that is $180,000 currently. If the value of those livestock losses exceeds that budget, then we have to prorate, and we have prorated the last 2 years. So 2 years ago, producers got 86 cents on the dollar, and this last year they only got 76% on the dollar. So I think that's important as we talk about recommendations, and many of these unit recommendations include these concerns, and they're trying to make recommendations to address some of those concerns. So let's move into unit by unit. really quickly. So the way that the overall state recommendation for mountain lion numbers works is each individual mountain lion unit in the and district biologist makes a recommendation for their unit. The statewide recommendation is just the sum of those. And so this is where the decisions are being made unit by unit by district biologists and regional teams. So rather than go through all of these, let me just point out the changes. And then obviously if we've got specific units we want to discuss, we can come back to it if that's okay. So the first change we're recommending, this is Northern Region, Box Elder Desert, we're recommending an increase of 5 permits and changing that from a split unit to harvest objective. So if we're changing a strategy, if it's in parens, that's what it used to be, and the one that's not is the one that we're recommending that we change to. The other thing on this chart on the left-hand side is whether or not that unit qualifies for predator management for a prey species that falls within the unit. And so if it's BHS, it would be bighorn sheep. And that's there are some parameters in the plan that would qualify a unit for predator management. And so just FYI, that's what that means. So if it says no, it doesn't qualify, and you'd expect us to manage to the plan's parameters. If it says yes, then we may be making recommendations that put us above those parameters in order to protect the prey base. So the next change we're recommending is on the Box Elder Raft River, recommending 2 additional permits. Next, East Canyon, we're recommending an additional 5 permits on that unit, changing it from limited entry to split. That's one where we've got some livestock concerns. Wildlife Services has been working it, but as a general rule, we try when we have the opportunity to allow sportsmen to take those lions if we've got livestock concerns. The other part of this is adding a split would allow a producer, once that harvest objective season opens, to go buy a permit over the counter and handle their own concerns. So that's the thinking behind changing it from limited entry to split. The next one, similar reasoning, is Morgan Southridge, increasing by 5 and changing from limited entry to split. The next unit is the Ogden. We're actually below we're above the 40% females on that unit. So we're recommending 2 changes to address that. One is to lower the permits by 1 and also to change that from harvest objective to split. Usually if people have a limited entry tag, they're more reluctant to take a female, so we're hoping we'll see that female number drop by making those 2 changes, and we'll keep an eye on it and see how that goes. So moving to Northeastern Region, we're not recommending any changes to any of these units. Still in Northeastern Region, we're recommending 4 additional in South Slope Bonanza, Diamond Mountain Vernal, an additional 5 on the Wasatch Mountains of Inniquin Wildcat, and an additional 3 on the Wasatch Mountains Current Creek North. The Central Region, Nebo West Face, increase of 3. Central Mountains Northwest Manti, we're recommending an increase of 2. Central Mountains Southwest Manti, an increase of 6. Oker Stansberry, increasing by 2 and changing that from limited entry to split. This is primarily to try to address some concerns we've got with that new bighorn sheep herd that's been put out there. That's a tough one, and it's tough to get quota, so we're hoping by making someone draw a tag and have to hunt that unit that maybe we'll get a little more harvest. Wasatch Mountains Cascade, this is again one that's exceeding its quota on females, and so now the exceeding the 40% females in the harvest, so recommending a decrease of permits by 1. Wasatch Mountains Timpanogos, same thing, we're recommending a reduction of 2. West Desert Tintic Vernon, increase from 9 to 12. So moving to the southern region. On the beaver unit, recommending going from 9 to 13. On the Fillmore Pavant, an increase from 14 to 19. The Kaparowitz, just quickly in case people don't remember, there are units in the state where secondary prey is limited, and the primary source of prey for a mountain lion would be bighorn sheep. On those units, we can recommend an unlimited season. They also have relatively low mountain lion numbers as a result of just not having a prey base. And so in actual practice, those unlimited units over 3 years are usually only harvesting one or two lions. I think the most is probably four over 3 years. So just low densities, it works there to just let people hunt. I think the idea is if you're out there hunting something else, or you've got a sheep tag and you see a lion while you're hunting sheep, you could have a lion tag, a harvest objective tag in your pocket and take that lion. There's a few more units like that, just to explain that. The Monroe from 9 to 15, and the Panguitch Lake increasing by 2. On the Ponsagant, that's had a quota of 10 every year for at least the last 3 years, and we just don't hit the quota on the Ponsagant. And so what we discussed doing is changing a couple things and seeing if we can maybe focus a little bit more harvest down there. The first thing is to change it from harvest objective to split. So again, 10 people would draw a tag for the Ponsagant, and that's the only place they could hunt. That's the first part of it. The second part has to do with seasons. When we get to that, I'll point that out. Pine Valley North increased 2. The Plateau Boulder increase 2. And Plateau Thousand Lakes, this is a low quota unit, but they'd like to switch that to split 2. Even with 4, they struggle sometimes to meet that. Got some deer concerns there. And finally, the Zion, they're recommending an additional 3 permits. Moving to the southeastern region, on the Central Mountains Northeast Manti, we're recommending an additional 3 permits. On the Central Mountains Southeast Manti, we're recommending 4 more. No changes recommended for these units. No changes here either. Okay, so that's all the unit by unit recommendations. This graphic just kind of shows how things shake out between pure quota units and then units that are either limited entry or split. I think it's like 51% limited entry split and 49% harvest objective this year. That would change from what it was last year. So season dates, if they're in white, these are just adjustments for the calendar year, so same season. So in green there, you see the Ponsagant. We talked about this just a second ago. What we'd like to do there, in addition to changing that to a split unit, is keep the harvest objective portion of that unit open throughout the summer. I know it's tough to hunt mountain lions in the summer, but what we're hoping is most harvest objective and split units, they're closed in March, February, March. And so the Ponsagant would be one of a hand, two or three units that would probably still be open during the summer. So if anybody was inclined, they could still go down there with a harvest objective tag and hunt. So again, we want to see what happens, but the thought here is maybe we'll get a little bit more attention down there on those mountain lions. And because we want to focus attention on the Ponsagant, we don't want to have that season for any other split units, just the Ponsagant. The other, this is kind of a minor change, but we used to have two different seasons for harvest objective and unlimited units, and there was like a 3-day window on harvest objective between the date it ended and then the date it opened for the next season. And that was, we did that because the rules, you have to wait 3 days between the time you buy a permit, you can harvest a lion, and that's to prevent people from treeing a lion and then running down to Walmart and getting a tag and going and shooting it. But we didn't think that the season needed to to have that window. So we're just recommending that that's just a year-round season. Obviously, if the objective is filled on the harvest objective unit, it would close anyway. So in a practical sense, we weren't running that season through the summer in most cases anyway. And then finally, pursuit is just adjusted for the calendar year. So a couple of quick informational items. These are just things that we wanted to make the RAC aware of. In the fall, you may remember, we made some changes in the big game rule to the requirements for archery tackle. We're just going to make those changes in this rule so everything's the same across all of our rules. And we're doing that at the direction of the Wildlife Board. When they made that change, they asked us to make sure that was a change across the board. And then finally, we're going to be beginning a 5-year PhD study on mountain lions in the state to add to a lot of the really good research that's taken place here. The technology and GPS collars is just leaps and bounds, and it keeps growing. And we're going to get some really neat data. These collars will be taken at location every 2 hours. We're going to have collars in the northern part of the state, some down here in sort of the central part. We're looking at either the Manti or the Wasatch. We'll work that out with the regions. And then the Book Cliffs would be the third unit that we'd be looking at. We're also going to do something simultaneously on the Poncegon. This study will be through USU. The Poncegon will be a BYU study to kind of look at how cougars interact with those deer, especially that long migration that we have on the Poncegon. That's one of the unique long migrations that we see in the state. So this is pretty exciting. One thing it'll do is it'll really help tighten up our estimate of numbers. We're going to look at female survival, and that's pretty key to trying to figure out how many there are. And the other thing that there isn't a lot of data on that we're really interested in is kitten survival. And so once we get a female collared, we'll monitor her, and when she dens up with kittens, we'll go in and collar the kittens and track their survival over time. So that's pretty exciting. We're also going to be looking at cougar and bear interactions. We've had a couple cases, or one case, on the Book Cliffs. We've documented where it looks like a bear has been bumping a mountain lion off of a kill, and we're curious about how often does that happen, and if it does, does that increase the rate that a mountain lion has to kill deer in order to maintain life, I guess is the best way to say that. So that's a question that's been speculated about. We're hoping to get some hard data on that. So we'll keep the RAC posted how that goes. Should be really interesting. That's all I've got.
Okay. So before we take questions from the RAC, I just want to tell the audience, if you have comments, make sure you fill out a comment card. We have no comment cards currently. Oh, good job. Good. Okay. So questions from the RAC.
Just out of curiosity, does the division have a rough estimate?
We do.
Population?
I don't remember how much. I know we did a training on this, and some of you may have been there and some of you haven't. So let me just quickly explain. I'm sensitive to your time. But what we're doing now is a virtual population a reconstruction, and that's based on cougars that are turned into us. And so the way that works is, say you had this year when people turned in lions, we had 10 that were 4 years old that were killed throughout the state. It's more than that, but let's just use that because my math is, I have a hard time. So we'll take 10. That means, theoretically, that last year those 10 lions were 3 years old and they were alive because they had to be alive in order to be killed at 4 year olds the year before. You also had a number of 3 year olds that were killed the year before. So you can add the 10 that were 4 to the 3 that were killed the year before, and then those numbers can be added to the 2 year olds because they were all alive the year before. This works best on a large scale because mountain lions can move around a lot. It's harder on individual units. So if you do that, That'll tell you how many of those animals you had to have in order to support the harvest that you've actually seen. So these are actual physical lions that we get our hands on. So that's an absolute minimum. So that's what we've done. Absolute minimum. The other thing you can do is if you think about that on a diagonal, it means that you kind of have to go back in time before you get a really good estimate. But if you can collapse the older age groups down, the diagonal shortens up, and that can get you further forward in time with an estimate. Does that make sense? I'm like seeing it in my mind, and sometimes, and I look at it a lot. So anyway, if we do that, what we can say is that we think, well, okay, so here's the results of this. So again, bear in mind this is an absolute minimum based on numbers, and this is adult lions 2 years old and older. So this doesn't include yearlings, it doesn't include kittens. The one cool thing about this, though, is that even though this is a minimum, there's a certain amount of natural mortality that occurs in Stoner, you know, and Monroe found it's probably about 10%. That would shift your number estimate up because you have to add those in, but it doesn't change your trend that much. And so I wouldn't get hung up on the 2000 number as much as I would just, this is what we think based on that the population's been doing since about 2004. It's been growing, and we think we've probably seen some reduction this last year. But in this method, those last years are the most fuzzy. So I say last year, this is 2017. So this doesn't include last year's harvest. So again, it's something we need to keep an eye on. But the trend before that is pretty solid. I'm pretty confident that we're probably seeing some leveling. What's interesting is if you put that on top of the mule deer graph, which is the blue line here, we think what's going on is that as we've been growing mule deer in the state, we've been growing mountain lions in the state. Another thing you see is that when the mule deer numbers started to decline in 2015, this is like almost too good in terms of predator-prey relationships. You see this lag in the predator, you know, they kind of overshoot, and then you start to see a decline. So as the prey base declines, you got too many mountain lions with too few resources, and you start to see those declines. So this is what we look at. I think the study and the reason we're doing it is we'd like to get better at this, but that's kind of a long-winded answer. I hope that helped.
Exactly.
Your Ponsonagunt summer hunt stuff, is that up where you have the bear in the unit too?
There are some bears on.
Lion, yeah. Hunters hunting your bears?
You might.
There you will.
Yeah, chasing bears. Yeah, they
you could guys
be out
thought
there.
Of that?
You could. Yeah, that, you know, that bear populate. We need to keep an eye on it. There are bears there. It's relatively low bear population. It's not like a mecca for guys that want to chase a bear. It's not like, you know, the LaSalle's or the Book Cliffs. But does the biologists are aware of that. And
impact bother you, or? It's okay. Collateral damage?
I don't think it's significant enough, but we'll have, again, you know, they haven't been filling the quota down there. There aren't a lot of guys out there. So if all of a sudden this becomes real popular and we get reports from the field that they're just chasing bears, they're not really chasing lions, we can make adjustments. So we'll keep an eye on that.
Okay. Number two, you keep statistical data on how many lions in the Book Cliff unit and the LaSalle unit are harvested by out-of-state hunters.
I have those numbers for the Book Cliffs. I don't have it for the LaSalle's handy. That's something I'd have to go back to licensing and find, but let me show you. Okay, so we figured this would come up since it's come up at every other rack, so I put a graphic together. So this is what we've seen since 2009 in terms of non-resident harvest and resident harvest. The resident harvest is in green. This is the Book Cliffs unit. And non-resident harvest is in red there. So it looks, and in 2013, that unit switched from split to harvest objective. And so we're seeing a lot more non-residents taking lions on the book cliffs than residents. Those two points are diverging. Usually the next question, I don't want to preempt anyone's question to me, is, you know, what do I think about that? Our main concern is we do have some concerns about the mule deer herd out there. We're seeing low adult survival. It's one of the things we want to look at with this study with collared lions and collared bears as well. But whether it's a non-resident that takes that lion or a resident, biologically, doesn't really matter. We just need to make sure that quota is being hit.
Right. I'm not, for once in my life, I'm not going to have a big argument.
Maybe I'm preempting.
I don't have an issue with your numbers. What I have an issue with, and that the sportsmen are hitting me with, is opportunity.
Yeah.
You've got people paying $500 for found tracks. You got outfitters all over. Your in-state opportunity is tanking. Your sportsman that has a job and tries to go hunt and don't have an opportunity to go. And where you're talking your split unit, we'll put your hunter there and let him hunt it and hunt it.
Right.
That sounds tailor-made to let some of the people in-state go hunting.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that really is a social life. This is a perfect opportunity for a group like this to take a crack at.
That's all I got.
Good job.
I have a question. I think it was back showing your recommendations. I believe it was in the northern unit somewhere. You showed two units that you were decreasing tags on, and those units were harvest objectives, and they were remaining harvest objectives. Is that... Yes. One of the others you lowered, and you changed it from harvest objective to split.
It's probably these two.
Yeah.
The hope there is that we can still allow that hunt strategy and address the females in the harvest by lowering the permits. So I think, you know, these are two different regions. They're kind of coming at it from two different directions. And I like to support the local biologist when, you know, on each district. So you will see things like that. But
just curious why you did that on one and not the other.
Yeah, it's just you got two different biologists that are trying some ideas, and that's the only reason.
Okay. Any more questions from the rack? So if not, let's take questions from the audience. If you'd like to step up to the mic. Okay.
Hi, Webster. You go to your population estimate. Can you explain where you come up with your estimates for 2004? Because as per your Cougar Management Plan 1999, the estimate was 2,500 to 3,900 cougars in the state. You're only showing 1,000. Can you explain that to me? That's out of your own plan. Doing this for 35 years, and I've never seen that number as low as 1,000 ever.
So the number in the plan, guy, is based, it's not this. It's not based on this population reconstruction. So this is based on cougars checked into us. And again, don't get too caught up on the number. It's the trend, right? Because this is just harvested lions. We know there are more lions in the population than what gets harvested, but the number in the 99 plan is based on what they did is they took cougar habitat throughout the state and they estimated about how many cougars could be supported by those habitat types, and then they just added it to get they just multiplied habitat by
lions. But to clarify, that would be a minimum, but more than likely you could have easily had the 2,500 to 3,900 in 1999.
Right, yeah. And that would relate to what natural mortality is, so hopefully that helps.
Okay. Just clarifying.
Darius Jones. The difference between limited entry and harvest objective, I know you, this division hopes that on harvest objective you reach the objective. On limited entry, do you look at hunter success and add tag numbers, figuring you're going to get the average success? I mean, is there more tags issued than what you really feel is going to be harvested?
Darris, what we do, we just look at those numbers, and a lot of these units where we're recommending increases are way low on their females in the harvest, which would indicate you could allow more opportunity. And a lot of these are over on the age, and so it's just most general rule of thumb, if it's two or three permits, it's just the biologist seeing there's opportunity and making adjustments. If they're five or six, there's probably some other issue, either a natural prey or a livestock concern.
And my question is on limited entry, do you issue more tags based, you have a target number of cougars you want harvested, but based on hunter success from past years, is there more tags?
I think the biologists take that into account. Yeah, they do, but a lot of these, I think there's only two limited entry units, just flat, straight limited entry. So, but yeah, the rest would essentially be a quota once it opens.
So then on the split units, it would be the same as harvest objective. You're hoping to reach that number of harvest. Okay.
Maybe the flip side of that, Darris, would be that we don't want more than that taken. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But as far as the health of the cougar population, if you did reach your quota, you wouldn't be worried.
Right, yeah.
What would be the biological impacts from including leg hold traps as a legal method of harvest on cougars? On harvest objective.
Well, the only biological thing that's come out lately has been the work that was done in Nevada on incidental trapping of lions. That seems to indicate that, you know, if lions lose toes, you know, you don't always hold them. But again, these aren't set for lions. They're set for usually for bobcats or something like that. You may have an added mortality effect biologically by allowing trapping as a method to take. And then there's the social side. And I think that'd be a hard pull to try to add trapping as a method. But that's just I'm just speculating on the social side.
Would making leg hold traps a legal method of harvest of cougars, would that be a rule change or a code change?
I'm going to say a rule change. I think that's all it would require. Yeah, I don't think it's in code. I think the code just says that the Wildlife Board will determine methods to take. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Any more questions from the audience? All right, so we'll begin to take comments. Let's start with Brett from Utah Farm Bureau. Brett Bailey.
First of all, we appreciate the recognition of the impacts to livestock predation, and we appreciate the increases in tag numbers. Obviously, there's an upward trend with all of our predator species. As we see that, a lot of our livestock men, especially the sheep guys, are affected significantly. We had some guys last night that were indicating between the two of them they lost 1,500 lambs last year. And when you start putting that into perspective, you know, each of them could buy a brand new pickup truck every year. So as these predation losses affect our ranchers, who are very marginal at best with the livestock prices that we have right now, we're really in fear of our sheepmen going out of business in the state. So as we look at these units and we see increases in tag numbers, we really appreciate that. The other thing is we're looking at, we would like to recommend maybe a multiplier effect. We don't think that the actual losses, the documented kills, are accurate. In other states, Wyoming, Idaho, and surrounding states, they'll have a multiplier effect of 3 to 4 in most cases on lions, and it's different for bears and coyotes and other species. But to accurately reflect the losses, we think we're probably only capturing about 25% of the actual losses that are taking place. So as we go forward, we'd love to find a way to deal with the new reality, which is, you know, look at the trend line. I'm not sure what the numbers are, but we know that we're increasing all of our predators, and as we do so, our livestock are being impacted. So in the new reality, to keep our people in business, we've got to find a way to compensate them and to help them document their losses. So in order to do that, you know, hopefully we could come up with maybe an easier way to document losses. One would be an app that could use smartphone technology to have more biologists, even in the DNR, instead of just Wildlife Services documenting the kills, having them certified, and then maybe some kind of other self-certification process so that we can actually capture the losses that are taking place. That would be a really big help. And then as we do so, then we can help to come up with a way to compensate these guys for the losses that they're taking. So we recognize it's a multiple-use state. We want to have our sportsmen have plenty of lions, but in the event that there are lions, we hope that our houndsmen and hunters get the opportunity to take those to the maximum extent possible. So when we have problem lions, if there's ways that we can include them in the process rather than just our government trappers, we'd love to find win-win solutions for everybody. So we support the recommendations that are made tonight, and we would take all that we can get in the future too. Thank you.
So next, Shane Thompson, Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife.
Shane Thompson, I'm here representing our group, and as a fulfillment, we voted to accept the recommendations the DNR are proposing to you, and along with Mr. Thierry to support their recommendation on the book cliffs to go to a split unit. And also, there was a recommendation they want to start doing some GPS reporting on the harvest too, as well, and we'd support them on that. So, and that's as our group, and I appreciate everybody's work and effort to do this, and there's some pretty good opportunity for the lions, and we want to keep the sportsmen out there as long as there's predators there and an opportunity to harvest them, and let's do it. So appreciate it.
And then lastly, Darius Jones representing himself.
Darius Jones, in light of Darren's kind of opening comments with, I think it was New Hampshire, you indicated showed a lot more support for trapping than maybe Connecticut. Okay, sorry, Connecticut showed more support for trapping than some people might have predicted. I guess I predict that Utah has a lot more support for trapping than is currently felt at the moment. The Farm Bureau's comment about using sport harvest to help take care of problem animals, I think ADC would probably use a leg hole trap to remove problem animals. Why not use licensed trappers to assist, have an opportunity to harvest a cougar with a leg hole trap? I guess in light of that, I would encourage this RAC to make a motion to have the Wildlife Board kind of look at possibility of using leg hole traps as a legal method of harvest for cougars on harvest objective units. Thanks.
Okay, so that's it for comments from the audience. So, I told you twice.
I'm trying to mind my business.
I'm too. I don't want to mess with it. Okay. All right, so let's do Cody Webster representing himself. I know.
Cody Webster. I would just recommend to also move the book cliffs to the split unit. We are kind of surrounded here with sheep units that are seeing zero harvest. The sheep units are supposedly the high priority to harvest the cats. There's not really a reason for a houndsman to go run the sheep units when you've got everywhere else open as well. And as well as the fact that the book cliffs is trending upward on the female harvest and is over the 40%, I think if we move that back to the split, that would force some of the hunting pressure to the sheep unit surrounding, kind of curb the bad trend on the buck list as well as focus the harvest of the sheep units.
Thank you. And then Guy Webster representing Utah Helmsman.
Hopefully everybody got our email.
I got it.
I know there were some. Daryl didn't do it. Update your email or something.
My email crashed. It's dead.
Did get it to him. I'm here representing Utah Helmsman Association and all of our members. We study the management plan. We've been involved with the management plan. There's some concerns with it. 1999, we're sitting here talking about these populations increasing. We beg to differ with that. 1999, we were claiming to have anywhere from 2,600 to 3,900 cougars in the state. 2017, they're estimated at 1,900 to 4,000. Essentially the same. We're not seeing the increase in cougars. There's been a little bit quoted possibly a 4% increase in the populations, but we're not seeing that. Also, going forth, looking at this, we're asking for zero increase in tags. Over the last 4 years, there's been a 26% increase in tags statewide for cougars, with an additional asking this year of 12%. It's went 7.5%, 7.5%, 8%, and now we're asking for 12. The plan says we can ask for increases, but the plan also says that there is nowhere in there that the increases are required. It says you may. It does not say you shall. We ought to stay with where we're at. We have no business increasing permits again. That's 41% increase over the last 5 years if you go with the DWR's plans. That's ridiculous. We talk about the buck cliffs, increase, you know, the decrease of deer, the problem with deer. Our wildlife board voted to increase deer tags this last year. If the deer are in such a dire, probably, why are we increasing deer tags? Also our management plan. We call to minimize predator management units. We've went from 22 to 30 in the last 3 years. That is not a decrease. That is not following the plan. We look at the other part of the plan. When there's 51 units in the state, 10 of those units are over 40% female harvest. An additional 9 are not meeting the age objective. These are numbers right out of the plans. This is actually numbers. The plan's right here. I'd be happy to sit down with any one of you. But what we're asking for is zero increase statewide. Stay with the 2017-2018 numbers, which was still a 26% increase over 2015. And we're specifically asking for the buck cliffs to go to a split. The non-resident issue out there has become absolutely absurd and stuff. We got guys paying $500, like Daryl said, to find them a track. If lines are so prominent, why are we have to pay outfitters paying $500 for a track? The Monroe unit specifically, 60% increase asked for just this year alone. The Southwest Manti proposing 6 increase. That's 35% increase this year. Since 2014-15, that's a 200% increase tags on that unit. And also, once again, we're begging for GPS coordinates to be done. We have to do it for coyotes. There's not a houndsman out there that's not running GPS, and if that one houndsman isn't, guess what, Google Earth, you can pull up them coordinates. Gives the tools for the fishing game to go back and verify where that harvest did in fact take place if there's ever a question on that. But I ask you to take a motion that we maintain where we're at. Our population is not increasing, but yet our harvest is gone through the roof, and we need to just be sensible in what it is. Nowhere in the state are we doing anything for any other animals with a 41% increase in tags over 5 years.
Thank you. So, Guy, just really quick, is it okay if I ask him a question? If we go with a motion for 0% increase across the board and that passes, that basically eliminates this you specifically talking about Monroe and Central?
Yes, yes, okay. It would. If you would not do it across the board, okay. Zero increase was specifically on those two units. We've taken them and said that are a little bit more high priority units, but we're asking zero increase statewide.
Okay. So we're going to take comments from the BRAC, but I think before we start making motions, and let me know, I think we need to break this up, if you guys are okay with this, and I'm going to mention some things, and then if you want to add some things to my list, let me know. So Beaucliff's going to the split. 0% increase across the board. The GPS coordinates on kills, and then leg hole traps on cougars. Do we want to add anything to that? And like I said, if the 0% increase across the state doesn't go, then we'll look at Monroe and the Central Manti. You guys okay with that? Okay. But if we have other comments, we should go with that first. But let's not start making motions.
So what you want to do is get the non-controversial stuff out of the way first.
You want to go for it?
I make a motion we adopt the split. Okay, oh, you want comments first?
No, let's take comments first, and then let's get into motions. Yeah, are you okay with that?
Yeah.
Okay. One comment, I guess, or, sorry, question. We have the GPS capacity on the coyote kills. Is that correct? Could we, this is, I guess, more of a question, but can we?
Yeah, we're supportive of asking for that, and that's the direction we're headed. I'd like to see this coyote thing work first before we add, you know, I anticipate doing lions and bears, and we'd like to ask Wildlife Services as well to use something like that. So there's some development time in that. We could require it, and then just people would have to, like Guy said, get it off of Google Earth or their own GPS unit. With an app, we'd be able to verify it a little bit better. So yeah, that'd be my plan would be to go that way anyway. We're just not recommending it this year.
Okay. Yeah, it seems
well,
like
it's already been talked about.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That I agree. I think it really could help us with our management to know where those lions are being taken and address some of these source sink. I think some of what's being observed in the field and what's showing in the data is a matter of source populations that are filling in to these areas where people are hunting pretty hard. So it looks like there's not very many, but they're taking lions year after year because they're being replaced by adjacent units. So was that the only question? Okay.
Any reason not going to split on the book list?
The only thing I'd say about that is that we're concerned that we make sure we're taking enough lions in order to address the concerns we have. So if we go to split, I think that we would recommend an increase in the permits because in the past the success for split has been somewhat less than with Harvest Objective. They're filling the quota.
You just said that the split unit was going to guarantee a better harvest in the Poncegon. Which side do you got here? Let's pick a side. You can't have it both ways. I'll calm down. That's bull.
It depends on how hard it is to hunt. Everybody, I mean, you can drive in a two-wheel drive car out on the book cliffs and hunt lions, according to the guys that are talking to me and the houndsmen that have talked to me. Poncegon's hard to hunt. They don't get the snow conditions. It's remote. And well, so they're not filling the quota down. They're not filling the quota down there. On the book cliffs, they are filling the quota. They're hitting 29. Well, two out of the last
okay,
years.
Okay, so what makes you think the guys that are hunting the split aren't going to hit it either? I mean, they're there. They've got the dogs. They're going.
They haven't in the past. That's the only thing I have to go on. When it was split before, they weren't. They weren't filling the quota. So that in order to get the harvest we want, we may have to increase tags.
I think
that's the only, I just want to throw that out for
that's
you.
Bad.
Okay.
Sorry, I didn't mean to raise your blood pressure again.
Yeah, you can't have both ways. It doesn't work.
Well, I like Daryl too. That's
I know. So any other general comments? And if not, I'll kind of start leading us in.
I got a couple of comments. When I had some of the houndsmen approach me about, you know, the book list particularly and the non-resident issue, and so I asked Darren to pull some
additional data, and he included some of that here tonight. And there's no question that in 2014, when that unit went to harvest objective, the number of cougars that were killed by non-resident increased significantly, and the number taken by residents decreased. Before it was quoted, it ranged from 54% to 71% of the cougars killed were killed by resident. After that, it's dropped as low as in this last year was 21% killed by resident. So it is a significant number. However, one thing I want to point out to the guy, and I haven't had a chance to look at all the units that you say. You say it's going against the plan to be over 40% females, but if it's a harvest objective unit, the management plan is to harvest over 40% females.
It can be on certain predator management tracts.
Yeah. On a split unit or limited entry unit, then the strategy is to take less than 40%. So I'm not sure how many of those, but I do know the Book Cliff is a harvest objective unit, and it did go over the 40%, but that basically follows the plan. So I just want to make that clarification, because from your remarks, it sounded like there was a lot of units that were going against the management plan by being over that. And there may be some. Like I say, I haven't looked at all of them, but I know there are some that fall under that harvest objective, and so that would actually be following the plan. I guess the other comment I have is going back to the concerning the Book Cliffs, and also concerning the Southwest Manti. I'm going to go to that one first. Southwest Manti, I think I'd have a very hard time not going with the division's recommendations there. I know for years the division has recommended increases on tags there, and it's passed in the racks numerous times, gone to the Wildlife Board, and they've kept it. So there were several years there when there were recommendations to have the tags increased, and they didn't increase them. Looking at the data there, it's certainly eligible for increase on tags. And where our deer unit, the South Manti particularly, is struggling so hard, I would struggle to support a no increase on that unit. Back to the Book Cliffs, even though the harvest objective, I guess my concern is somewhat what the division or what Darren mentioned. I'm in favor of going back to a split unit, but my concern is that if the resident hunters are not filling the quota, and you know, we'd have to look at going back to the harvest objective. But I do like the idea of, I don't like the idea of the non-resident hunters coming in and taking opportunity away from resident sportsmen. So.
Okay. Any other general comments? And if not, I'm going to start with what I deem as the easier ones. Is that okay? Let's start with GPS coordinates. Do we have a motion on that?
I'd like to make a couple comments on it, and then a motion.
Okay, great.
So just so I don't know if everyone fully understands the exact reasoning for that, but probably the Book Cliffs and the 9 Mile are the worst units in Utah as far as needing that. You've got guys hunting the exact same roads. I spend over 100 days a year on 9 Mile, and everybody kills all the outfitters. They're hunting Argyle Canyon, 9 Mile Canyon, all the easy stuff, clear away from where our sheep even are. Our sheep are down by the river. They're not even hunting that country. They're not going across to Turtle Canyon. They're not. It's going to help show the DWR that that's an issue, that the Tavaputs Plateau, Range Creek, all that is a feeder. It's got a huge population of lions, and that's what's keeping Argyle and Nine Mile rotating through so many lions. But the average lion being killed is on that end is younger, that they're
right.
But so I think it's really important. That's definitely something we need. And Book Cliffs is the same. They're not hunting down by the river. They're hunting the easy stuff.
Yeah.
And so that being said, I'd like to make a motion that we adopt a GPS thing. And you know what Darren said with the looking at waiting, having an app or something. Every houndsman has a GPS. All they got to do is look on their thing.
Right.
Like right now, we're required, if you kill wild sheep, to turn in the drainage you killed it in. It's just general location, the drainage. I think GPS would be better, but I think we should adopt something immediately.
Okay.
And then work towards the GPS.
Okay. So we have a motion by Jay Skyman to request that a lion kill come with GPS coordinates. I'm not probably saying that correctly.
Cord sighting.
You want to say that? And we got a second by Kent Johnson. Makes some sense.
Good night, Morgan.
Okay. All in favor? Okay, that's unanimous. Great.
Good job.
Let's go to Book Cliffs and the split unit.
Here we go. Go ahead and take a stab at the motion.
Okay, he wants to make a stab. Do you want to make a stab?
You're first.
Yeah, no, he was already like, he was.
I'll make a motion that we accept the split unit and leave the numbers where they are for right now. You know, we'll find out quick enough if it isn't working. Instead of taking a knee-jerk stab at fixing something, we don't even know it's broke.
Okay. So we.
So I'd adopt the split unit strategy on the Book Cliffs.
So we have a motion by Daryl Meekum to take the Book Cliffs East unit and move it from harvest objective to split, leaving the numbers at current 2017 numbers. And we have a second by Kent Johnson.
And make sure we put in there, or when you present it to the board, why we're doing it.
Yep.
That, you know?
Yep. Yeah, I will. Okay, all in favor?
Concerns too.
Yeah, all in favor? Yes. Oh, it's unanimous. Would anybody like to entertain a motion about a recommendation of using leg hole traps as a method of taking lion?
So I'll do a brief comment on it first. I personally would love to go out and set a leg trap and catch a lion. I think that'd be awesome. But I think the social aspect, we'd be opening up a huge can of worms that we'd just see more negative backlash than positive. And so I'd make a motion that we not.
And it's not on there.
It doesn't even need anything. So that's my opinion.
Does anybody want to make a motion? If not, I just wanted to put it up there because it was presented.
Okay. Has the division looked into any studies on that?
Social study?
Obviously, there's enough contingency on killing them, let alone trapping.
Right, yeah. I mean, we did a study, I think, in 98 that just looked at attitudes towards hunting lions at all, and there's not a lot of support in the general public just with the whole concept. So I don't know what would happen, but I suspect if we introduced a new way to hunt that we'd probably get some backlash, but that doesn't mean that the board couldn't consider it. And while I'm up here, I know I've been talking a lot, if we're going to talk about South Manti, I've got a graphic I think it would help with the discussion if we get to that. So.
Okay. Well, we'll let that.
I'll make a motion that the board looks at it. I mean, ain't out anything to look at it.
So what do you want to look at?
Look at the study on doing it. That's Darris, do you want to, I mean, for us to look into it?
That was my recommendation, that the board put it on their action plan or something, just to consider.
I mean, we're not out anything.
Yeah, that would have to be a rule change anyway, right? So that would have to be something that went through that process. So I think a motion to have them look at that, to see if the rule changes.
I mean, it's that's an opportunity out there. I don't know. I don't see much difference in a lion and a bobcat. I really don't, but I know people do. So.
Okay. So, Jeff. We have a motion by Jeff Christensen. Is it for the board to look at feasibly using lake hole traps as a take method for mountain lion?
You all right with that, Darris?
Cougar, I should say.
I'll second that.
Okay, and a second by Eric Luke. All in favor? 5 and opposed. So we have Daryl Meekum, Kirk Player, and Jay Skyman opposed. And lastly, let's just talk about, I shouldn't lead you. I don't know if we want to go with what the houndsmen recommend, and we want to start there and see how that goes. Jace is ready. I can see it. Sweet.
I'm ready.
Great.
So first off, the manti. I know that the drivers are, for one, we're in predator management. Two, I think the Southwest manti is the highest lion predation unit based off our statistics. Is that the graph that you had?
Yeah, so what we've been doing with collared deer is collecting cause-specific mortality. And I've got something here that'll show you how that works. Okay. So really quickly, you can see the legend there on the right-hand side. Lion predation is represented in yellow. Orange. If you look at the South Manti, there's two that stand out, the Monroe and the South Manti. And what's particularly interesting and concerning about the South Manti is that those deer have relatively good body condition when we check body condition scores when we're checking collars. So that would indicate that they're not habitat limited. They're getting enough to eat. They're putting on fat. But we've seen increasing lion predation on that unit, and you can see, I mean, the bar is total mortality. It's over half is lion killed, and they're seeing a reduction in adult survival, and we think on that unit and probably on the Murrow that the lion take is a significant factor, and so that's why you're seeing the recommendations tonight. You are for the South Manti and the Monroe, but again, this may help with the discussion, but that's where we're coming from, our concerns.
Okay, so with that, though, the only thing I'm curious on is with our manti, our objective for our mule deer, is there at any point that we were actually at objective in history? Because I know over about the last 20 years we've never actually met that objective. So I'm curious if that's an unrealistic objective based off...
Can I use the short guy microphone? Is that all right? No. Those objectives were set in the 90s when we first started those plans. We've never been there. Our cougar management isn't really related to percentage of objective anymore. It's related to the adult survival on these radio collars. So that objective isn't as important in these cougar recommendations anymore. That answer your question?
Yeah, I'm just curious, that also relating to the Southeast Manti, though, where we're in predator management, that, and our statistics this year, I think, do reflect a change, even if it wasn't in predator management, but just where it is, it's been more of a focus, and I'm curious if we're at an unrealistic objective for deer, if there's other aspects, other things contributing to why we've never actually met that, why we're staying at 60% or wherever it's at.
Yeah, excellent point. Yeah, what the actual carrying capacity of that deer herd is is due to a lot more factors than just cougars, for sure.
I just wanted to put that out there to take the focus off lions. Obviously, Southwest Manti does have high lion predation, but just in general, put that in everyone's mind that there's something more there than just lions, that there's a reason,
right.
Extra factors why we're staying below that. On the Southwest Manti, I know with the statistics that Guy put forward, is it 27% increase from last year?
26.
35. 35% increase this year. And since 2014-15, went from from limited entry to split with 200% increase.
So if we keep stepping up this big of steps, I'm not opposed to a raise in tags, but 6 permits in 1 year, especially after we've raised the last 2 years, just seems really excessive, where we haven't even seen what the last 2 years of increase are going to do to the population. I see more of a yo-yo effect if we do that many. If anyone else has any comments, those are just things I wanted to put out. Somebody can add to it before we make a motion.
I think you're close.
Okay.
Actually, I believe that I don't believe there was an increase in tags 2 years ago, just last year.
Just last year.
Yeah. And that statistic shows the whole both Southwest and Southeast Manti, not just Southwest.
So that's a lot of material.
The main thing that they stated was 0% increase across the state. But do we want to? I'm just trying to lead us into something here. Uh-huh. We want to state that with an exception or two. An exception.
Or could we approach it as going like unit by unit? So in Central Mountains, instead of saying a 6 tag increase, say, well, we could support more of
that. Then we have to. We could do that, and then we have to deal with the rest. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So should I make a motion just on Manti? So I'd motion, because the Southeast and Southwest have raised in the last couple of years, that we lower the numbers, maybe 2 on each unit, just to avoid the yo-yo effect. We want to kind of hit the mid-ground and see where it goes. That sort of motion. Trying to think how to word it.
2 and 3?
Motion, 2 tags on each of the 2 Manti units, the Southeast, Southwest Manti, rather than the 4 and the 6.
So are both those, both the Mantis increased?
It's increased by 4 on the Southeast and increased by 6 on the
Southwest.
So you're
saying just increase both by 2?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And fill it out, look into it again, because the Cougar Management, it was on a 3-year rotation, and so I think if we just keep bumping it every year, where does it end?
Okay, so we have a proposal by Jay Skyman that on the Southwest, and what's the other
Southeast.
One? The Southeast Manti, that we limit that increase to 2 tags per unit. Do we have a second on that? We have a second by Kent Johnson. All in favor? In favor, all opposed. We've got Eric, Luke, and Todd Thorne opposed. Okay, great.
So it's 2 over the 2018 number?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay, so then do we have another motion on another unit, or do we have another motion on the remainder of the state?
I would make a motion that we accept the remainder of the state as proposed by the division.
Okay, so I have a motion by Eric Luke to accept the remainder of the division's proposal as presented, a second by Kirk Player. All in favor? 7 in favor, all opposed. 1 opposed, Daryl Meekum. Okay, so we are done with that. Thank you. And then, Jace, good job. Well, I was telling Jace, good job. Okay. And so finally we have, is that correct? Do we have one more presentation? Okay. Okay, by Brad Thompson, Sensitive Species.
Okay, I promise a couple things. First of all, I'm not Kim Hersey. She had a son with a medical emergency, so she couldn't come tonight. This will be quick. So these are just some minor amendments to the sensitive species rule that we need to get through and present. First of all, define what the sensitive species rule is. It is a state list. It's basically the goals of it are to reduce the likelihood of any sort of federal listing, Endangered Species Act sort of listing. It guides our management practices to certain species and meets our overall management goal to conserve the diversity of wildlife in the state of Utah. It identifies needs, species that need things through things we can control through wildlife management, habitat restoration. When we have species on this list, it allows us to look at impacts of oil and gas development, things like that, targeted at these specific species. Also helps us direct our funding, and targets specific species. Here's what it's not. There's no teeth to it as far as it is not a regulatory rule at all. It just guides us in how we focus on species. I'll just read this part because the wording, sensitive species designations may not be used by governmental entities as a basis to involuntarily restrict the private property right of landowners and their lessees or permittees. The idea behind the whole sensitive species list is to keep management in state hands and before it goes to federally listed and federally managed species. So what is a sensitive species? They're native species where there's substantial declines in either population or distribution, and where management or mitigation of threats is needed and can be done. So you identify things where you can help things out. Currently, you can see the breakdown of mammals, birds, and reptiles. It's about 104 species, I believe, that are on that list currently. Here's how they're designated. The DWR submits some recommendations, of species based on our data, where data is lacking. We have these declining trends, as I identified earlier. We assess the impacts, that could cause further declines. Then there's a committee that reviews that includes those people, mainly in the Department of Natural Resources, the Oil, Gas, and Mining, Water Resources, the PLIPCO, Division of Wildlife, and other department heads. And also, it's a public process, so any other interested persons can provide that input. That's presented to the Wildlife Board, and the Wildlife Board makes that decision on what species are on that list. What we're changing is a couple of little simple things. I think you guys all got a copy of that marked up rule. There's a whole lot of red in that. It was kind of a complicated list of stuff that wasn't actually getting done, so it simplifies and clarifies a lot of things and cleans up the rule. Among which, there's a whole lot of criteria about how we put in species and take them out, and based on endangered species criteria and things like that, it removes that. There's only one way to put them on the list and one way to take them off, and that's the stuff I just outlined to you. There also used to be a wildlife habitat designation associated with a sensitive species list that we're removing. It's simply because we weren't using it at all. Just to toot the horn of sensitive species stuff, it's proactive and voluntary. It works. Many species that are on the sensitive species list have been petitioned, and quite a pile of them were found as not warranted. There were three species that have been listed on the endangered species list, but nine that have come off. So it's just a real success story to be ahead of it, manage accordingly, and keep them off that list. We all don't want any new species on the endangered species list. With that, I'll have questions.
Thanks, Brad. Do we have any questions from the audience? I don't think we have any comment cards from the audience. Do we have comments from the REC? A motion.
A motion to accept the changes as proposed.
Okay, so we have a motion by Dana Truman to accept the changes by the division as proposed, and a second on that. Second by Jay Skyman, all in favor? And that is unanimous. Okay. We're done. Oh, no, we still have any more?
I don't think so.
Okay, great, we're done. Meeting is adjourned.